as the US weapons and energy sectors make enormous profits, while ordinary EU citizens pay a very high price. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iranians have held nationwide rallies to condemn the Wednesday terrorist attack in the southern city of Shiraz. The protesters took to the streets in different cities following Friday prayers. They chanted slogans and held banners, calling for the perpetrators and their backers to be brought to justice.
Today, we're here to show the world that we are all together. We are a powerful country. We're going to fight against terrorism. We're going to fight against violence. You want us to be separated. You want us to fight against each other, but we are the one. We are powerful.
At least 13 people, including two children, were killed after gunmen opened fire on pilgrims at the Shah Cheragh Holy Shrine in Shiraz. 26 others were wounded. The Daesh terror group claimed responsibility shortly after the attack.
We strongly condemn any acts of terrorism and desecration of Muslim sanctities. We want to say that we hate London-based news channels like Iran International, Manoto, and BBC because they are instigating violence and unrest in Iran.
We are here to send this message to Israel, the U.S., and their allies that through creating riots and unrest in the country, they cannot achieve their sinister goal of disintegration of Iran. We are united.
Leader of the Islamic Revolution Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has called on security agencies, the judiciary, intellectuals, activists and the entire nation to act in unison to confront the current which is disregarding and disrespecting people's lives, security and sanctities. Meanwhile, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has also vowed that the Islamic Republic would deliver a crushing response to those who were behind the bloodshed.
The ralliers have called on Iranian authorities to prosecute the main perpetrators of the heinous crime of terrorist attack in Shiraz and take all necessary measures to maintain security in the country as soon as possible. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
On Wednesday, Italy's new far-right-led government of Giorgia Meloni won a confidence vote in the Senate with 115 votes in favor, 79 against and 5 abstentions. The new executive can now get down to business. Meloni, aged 45, is the leader and one of the founders of Brothers of Italy, the party that spearheaded a right-wing coalition to victory in Italy last month's election.
Among the many weights I have on my shoulders today is the fact that I am the first woman ever to lead this nation as Prime Minister.
During Tuesday's first speech in the Chamber of Deputies, Meloni had presented a political program which aims as a priority to counter soaring energy bills and a looming recession. Among the main measures to take away are plans to introduce tax cuts, lift limits on cash transactions, taxing the excess profits of the energy giants in a windfall tax, and reallocating some of the EU pandemic recovery funds.
Ma la nostra priorità.
Our priority today must be to curb high energy prices and accelerate in every way the diversification of supply sources and domestic production. The context in which the government will have to act is very complicated, perhaps the most difficult since the World War II.
Also on Wednesday, Meloni went on saying that Italy will remain an active member of the EU on her watch and that it would continue to be a reliable partner of NATO in supporting Ukraine. Italy's new prime minister said that the only way to facilitate a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine is helping Kyiv to defend itself militarily. Meloni's two main allies, media magnate Silvio Berlusconi and League leader Matteo Salvini, are longtime admirers of Russian President Vladimir Putin. U.S. Embassy Chargé d'Affaires attended in person the confidence vote on Giorgia Meloni's new government at the Chamber of Deputies on Tuesday. Some fear Meloni could embark on a course of confrontation towards the Western alliance. Back in 2016, Meloni defined the European Union as rotten to its core, while in 2014, Italy's new prime minister staunchly opposed sanctions against Russia after its annexation of Crimea.
Yemen's Ansar Allah movement is doubling down on its threats to target foreign cargo ships attempting to enter Yemeni waters illegally to steal oil and other natural resources. This after the government recently fired warning shots toward a Greek oil ship attempting to illegally load an estimated 2 million barrels of Yemeni oil from a port terminal in the province of Hadramaut. The warning shots forced the Greek cargo ship to abandon its mission and use its own fuel to head back home empty-handed.
This fuel ship was attempting to steal 2 million barrels of Yemeni oil worth millions of dollars. This money is supposed to be allocated to the Central Bank of Yemen, which would then be distributed to pay labor salaries across the country. Unfortunately, this money was transferred to a bank belonging to the Saudi royal family and was used to fund the American-Saudi aggression on Yemen.
According to the government in Sana'a, ending years of plundering and looting of the Yemeni natural wealth is essential to stimulate the Yemeni economy. It also pulls Yemen out of the decades of poverty and economic instability, which has already left millions of Yemenis in poverty, an initiative the Sana'a government says is promising to make it a reality. Observers believe that the world now needs to recognize that it is dealing with a new Yemeni nation, one that will never compromise its dignity and sovereignty.
The new identity of Yemen is because people's demands are now being met, whereby the Yemeni people are finally getting what they deserve as they reap the benefit of their natural resources, which used to be exploited and plundered. The latest warning shots we sent are an example of the military and political leadership's strengths, pose, and determination to protect the people of Yemen.
Yemen has for decades been described as the poorest country in the Middle East. However, the underlying reasons why that is the case are hardly ever discussed. According to experts we spoke with, one of the main reasons is the systematic exploitation of Yemen's natural wealth by the UAE and Saudi Arabia.
With the latest developments, foreign countries and companies who have a history in plundering Yemen's natural resources will have to think twice about entering the country's waters illegally, as the Ansar Allah movement has made it very clear it will not hesitate to use decisive military force to protect what it calls the Yemeni people's wealth. Yusuf Mawadi, Sana'a.
During his first speech as British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak used the occasion to issue a call for unity. Sunak must find a way to quickly unite not just a bitterly divided Conservative Party, but also a deeply troubled nation. However, he also issued warnings of difficult times ahead.
I will place economic stability and confidence at the heart of this government's agenda. This will mean difficult decisions to come.
The Prime Minister has inherited a country in crisis. Energy prices are high, cost of living through the roof, and millions of Brits are expected to struggle this winter. Another worry for Sunak, Conservative Party popularity has plummeted in recent months, sitting approximately 30 points behind the opposition Labour Party. Sunak's supporters say he's economically experienced from his days as Chancellor and praised Sunak as Britain's youngest leader in 200 years and the first ever non-white leader. But his critics claim that's just not enough.
He definitely has the credentials, he definitely has the experience, been there in as Chancellor before. But again, we need to understand, you know, where does he sit right here, right now, with everyday voters? He has not been elected by the people, as well as most people feel that he cannot resonate with the ones that are struggling. I'm not sure if it is real representation for anyone of a minority background, especially when he comes from a very, very elitist club, and he does not really represent many. He's probably top 1% of majority of brown people or Asians, whatever you want to call it, in the entire world. So it's very difficult to sort of resonate and feel sort of close in that way.
Many challenges lie ahead for the new Prime Minister, in particular how he's going to overcome Britain's many economic crises. However, even if he does find a way to overcome Britain's economic woes, question marks still remain surrounding if he has what it takes to win the Conservatives the next general election. Robert Carter, London.
NGC 23 is a remote galaxy which is more than 200 million light-years away from Earth. What's even more interesting is that the interstellar object was observed by none of the celebrity telescopes like James Webb, but by a new indigenous Iranian observatory called INO, short for Iranian National Observatory, marking a milestone in the country's quest for deep space.
Within 3 weeks ago, which we got the first light, the so-called first light, we had no idea about the quality of the image we are going to get, and it was excellent.
Another debut image shot by the 3.4-meter optical telescope is ARP-282, an interacting galaxy pair located approximately 320 million light-years away. Scientists at the Iranian National Observatory say their telescope could see objects as far as 7 billion light-years away.
Of course, we can use this telescope to observe even deeper objects, but the highest quality of this telescope can be achieved up to 7 billion light years away from us.
INO is built on Mount Gargash, north of the city of Isfahan, at a height of 3,600 meters above sea level. The project was initiated about 15 years ago, aiming at the development of a medium-class telescope to provide a research facility for national users.
In the next coming months, and especially in the next year, the telescope will be delivered to the astronomers as the end user of this expensive and complex instrument.
Constructing INO was the result of complicated scientific and technological efforts, but there was even a tougher challenge, U.S. sanctions. The anti-Iran measures block high-tech imports and access to foreign know-how. The Iranian team purchased the glass mirror blanks from a German firm, but then had to figure out how to construct nearly everything else on their own.
Due to U.S. sanctions and some financial problems, they cut their relation with us, and we did the rest of project within last 12 years by ourselves.
INO is still not fully developed. Engineers need to integrate software, fine-tune the active optics, and install the first science instrument, a high-resolution imaging camera. Once completed, the telescope will help scientists understand galaxy formation and stellar evolution and hunt for exoplanets.
With INO, Iran has marked its first giant leap in space exploration and has fairly entered the world space race. The telescope's builders are now thrilled to announce that they will soon release more stunning images of deep space, hoping to help the world catch a glimpse of the wonders of our universe. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
In the limelight.
A new report shows that social media giants, including Facebook, TikTok, Twitter, and YouTube, have failed to curb the spread of right-wing extremism and disinformation on their platforms regarding the U.S. midterm elections. Meanwhile, a new poll shows that over 2 in 5 Americans say they are concerned about being subject to intimidation or violence when voting in the midterms. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the details, please. The website of Common Dreams wrote, Facebook, TikTok, Twitter and YouTube are failing to curb the spread of right-wing extremism and disinformation on their platforms and must immediately implement safeguards with the pivotal U.S. midterm elections less than 2 weeks away, a watchdog has warned recently. In empty promises inside Big Tech's weak effort to fight hate and lies in 2022, Free Press analyzed the policies of the four social media giants to measure how prepared each one is to combat Trump-backed efforts to sow doubts about upcoming electoral outcomes. According to Free Press, the problem is just as dire in advance of the 2022 U.S. midterms as it was during the nation's 2020 elections. In particular, the report found that the major social media networks have failed to clearly update their election integrity systems in time for the elections, created a labyrinth of company commitments, announcements, and policies that make it difficult to assess what they are really doing, if anything, to protect users, and failed to close what they call newsworthiness or public interest exceptions that give prominent users and politicians a get-out-of-jail-free card and allow them to post lies without consequences from the platforms. Free Press warned that these failures are likely to be felt not only at polling stations on November 8, but also on the streets. The unchecked spread of online lies about the 2020 election fueled real-world violence on January 6, said Nora Benavides, report author and senior counsel and director of digital justice and civil rights at Free Press, adding, and although most people in the United States now believe that big tech should do more to curb the online spread of disinformation and incitements to violence, social media companies keep failing to protect users. As the report notes, Change the Terms, a coalition of more than 60 civil and consumer rights organizations, developed a set of 15 priority reforms for social media companies to implement ahead of the midterm elections that would fight algorithmic implications of hate and lies, protect users across all languages, and increase company transparency. Our coalition, of which Free Press is a founding member, then met with Meta, TikTok, Twitter, and YouTube throughout the summer 2022, calling on each company to implement these 15 priority reforms as soon as possible and to share more data about their enforcement practices around election integrity. Although tech companies had promised to fight disinformation and hate on their platforms this fall, there is a notable gap between what the companies say they want to do and what they actually do in practice. In sum, platforms do not have sufficient policies, practices, AI, or human capital in place to materially mitigate harm ahead of and during the November midterms. Benen Davies said, even in writing, platforms like Meta, TikTok, Twitter, and YouTube can't commit to the most basic online protections to limit the spread of the disinformation and hate. And in practice, our research shows ongoing gaps in companies' enforcement of their own meager safety policies. She added, these are systematic failures across all of the major social media companies that show how little the companies care about safeguarding elections and fighting extremism and lies on their platforms. After Twitter's new mega billionaire owner, Elon Musk, fired several of the platform's key leaders immediately upon taking over, Benavides warned that content moderation on the site is poised to become even worse. Free Free Press urged Facebook parent company Meta, TikTok, Twitter, and YouTube to take the following steps to stem the spread of bigotry and lies on their platforms, including stop amplifying hate and disinformation content and implement algorithms without discrimination. Protect people equally around the world and across languages through increased resourcing for civic integrity teams year-round and boost transparency about company business models and moderation and enforcement practices, ensuring access to data for external researchers and journalists. We're less than 2 weeks from the U.S. midterms. Ben Davides tweeted, adding, over 30 other national elections have occurred around the world this year, featuring conspiracy theories and lies fanned by online rhetoric that social media companies allow to flourish. What will it take for the culture of big tech to change? What will it take for civil and human rights to become a real priority with evidence to show for it? Meanwhile, the website of Truth Out wrote, over 2 in 5 Americans polled over the past week say they are concerned about being subject to intimidation or violence when voting in the midterms. New polling finds in an alarming show of the state of democracy in the U.S. According to a poll from Reuters Ipsos of over 4,400 U.S. adults, about 43% of Americans say they are worried about facing threats at polling locations. Democrats are more likely to be concerned about violence at about 51% versus Republicans 38%. Likely fueled, at least in part, by the far-right's attack on the Capitol on January 6, 2021, Americans are also concerned that groups will carry out violence after the election if they are unsatisfied with the outcome. The poll found, with over 2 in 3 Americans saying as such. The poll comes as there have been reports of armed far-right vigilantes intimidating voters in Arizona. Though there have not yet been reports of violence, the vigilantes have apparently been taking pictures of people using ballot drop boxes and threatening to post their information online. The vigilantes appear to have been galvanized by debunked right-wing claims that so-called ballot mules are stuffing boxes with ballots for Democrats. While there is zero evidence of widespread voter fraud or anything resembling ballot stuffing, the belief appears to have become so entrenched that vigilantes are taking it upon themselves to supposedly guard ballot boxes. Despite having no basis in reality, voter fraud has become a concern among the public as well. The Reuters Ipsos poll found that nearly half of Americans think that voter fraud is a widespread problem, while only 40% disagree. Republicans are more likely to believe in this lie popularized by Donald Trump, with 2/3 of Republicans saying they believe that widespread voter fraud is an issue, and about 1/3 of Democrats saying as such. There have been other threats to voters from the right. In Florida, Governor Ron DeSantis' fascist election police arrested 20 people earlier this month, claiming that they knowingly violated election guidelines. But like many others who have been prosecuted for election-related offenses, those arrested were simply unaware of their voter eligibility status. In this case, some of the voters arrested were supposedly previously told that they were eligible to vote, but then they were arrested for illegally registering. At least 13 of the people who were arrested were black. The fact that concerns of violence in relation to casting a vote are so widespread and that there are already reports of intimidation is an alarming show of the erosion of democracy in the U.S. The far right has been ramping up voter suppression efforts in recent years, between the Republican Party's gerrymandering, plans to mass challenge election results, and infiltrate Democratic majority polling places or bills to flat out allow Republican officials to overturn election results. Experts say the GOP is setting the stage to rig elections so that they never lose or effectively lose despite voters' will again.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Chinese President Xi Jinping has been picked as the party's general secretary for a third time, which means that he will be the leader of China for another 5 years. In the 20th National Congress, the CPC, or Communist Party of China, highlighted its commitments to things like reducing inequality. That's a good cause. When it comes to hot-button issues like Taiwan, it refused to rule out the possibility of using force. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why China is going to do for the next 5 years and how that matters, especially at this point in time with the specter of the U.S. provoking it and drawing it into a war over a host of issues stands tall. Let me first introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us from Geneva is Peter Koenig. He's a geopolitical analyst and former World Bank economist. Welcome, Peter Koenig. And also we have from Detroit, Michigan, Haz Aldeen joining us. He's a political analyst and host of Infrared Show.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Peter Koenig, first I'll start with you. When we take a look at this next 5 years for Xi Jinping to have been picked, it's a good thing in terms of the commitments that he has given, in terms of things that he said he's going to cover, not only on the world scale but also domestically. But the way that the news is covered by some Western or many Western media outlets is he's holding on to power, extending his grip on power, surrounding himself with loyalists. Why do you think their take is different than the substance itself?
Thank you very much for having me. Well, I also think the re-election is a very good thing. It lends the country to more stability and continuity with the successful policy that he has certainly had in the past. We can talk about those too. I mean, what he has achieved. Now, the Western media, of course, and politicians, they have to criticize, they have to leave no good thing on China. So, but look at Madame Merkel, Germany's chancellor. She was in power for 16 years, was so-called re-elected four times, and nobody complained. The West applies different standards for what it perceives to be itself and her enemies. Now, the other thing that is also largely criticized, as you pointed out, that Xi Jinping surrounded himself with loyalists. Well, tell me one leader, including the U.S. and all of the Europeans and probably around the world, who doesn't set up a cabinet or a series of advisors that are not loyalists. I mean, this is normal. Any president does that, but why is it not correct if China does it? These are double standards, which I think we have to point out to the world and particularly to the media. So this is my take on these two issues. Now, if you like me to go into the achievements.
No, that's okay. We'll get into hopefully some of the areas that you deem also important on this. Hazeldine, I'm going to go to a couple, or really I should say one topic that seems to be one of the focus of this of the agenda of Xi Jinping for the next 5 years, and based on what has been covered in his speech, bolstering security and turning China into a technological power is very important for China. Now, we're going to get into technological aspect of it a little later, but national security, high on the agenda and a priority. Why do you think that's cited as a priority in the eyes of Xi Jinping?
Well, as China has entered a new phase of its historical development, which is moving out of the primary stage of modernization and industrialization that characterized the reform and opening up era, China is starting to be recognized around the world as a serious geopolitical player and superpower. And with that has come the understanding on part of the Chinese leadership that that's going to lead to an increased level of aggression and hostility from the world's premier superpower, which is the United States. So China has to prioritize national security now in ways that it wasn't before, because it is increasingly finding itself in the crosshairs of the State Department and the foreign policy agenda of the United States.
National security and then technology. Peter Koenig, those two have been covered out of this conference synonymously at the same time. And it's very interesting, the reason for that, which based on just some of the research done, it seems like the technological aspect is somewhat tied into what the U.S. has done recently when it comes to the issue of chips. We know that they've restricted
access to the Chinese when it comes to chips. Chips that, well, we know that they're for everyday appliances practically these days, but more importantly, it's used in the military arena. And the conclusion is that the U.S. is trying to prevent China from advancing in that field. Why do you think the U.S. wants to prevent China from advancing in that field?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure this can be taken seriously. I think this is more Biden's or the U.S. administration's bluff vis-a-vis the rest of the world. China is very much advanced in technology and chip technology and so on. China has almost all, if not all, of the raw materials, which means the rare earths that are needed for these technological approaches. So China has the capacity to be on its own, and that's why I wonder what is behind that. Of course, China needs to build up its military, and that is very clear. You pointed it out. You pointed out the reasons, and I agree with them. Especially, I mean, there is more going on. There's NATO encroaching on China from all sides, particularly the South China Sea, and conflicts are brewing everywhere in order to restrain China. So it is very logical that China has to build up, and does, has been doing so for the past 2 years. Its army and its technological advances in the military, while maintaining, and I would like to stress that, while maintaining a peaceful approach to what they call the modernization of China, actually the new direction that they're going into by reaching out to the global south. But as far as the U.S. so-called sanctions is concerned, they sound and read like terrific. I mean, I think Biden has threatened U.S. citizens or technological experts in China. If they don't quit their jobs immediately, they lose their nationality. So what? I mean, China has the technology themselves to continue working on it. And they also have, as I said, the raw materials. Uh-huh. So I'm not so sure whether this is a real threat or just bluff.
Well, based on the reports, it is a real threat. And it's interesting that you talk about rare earths, because, Hazeldine, China is not going to rule out not giving rare earths to the U.S., which would be a big catastrophe for the U.S. Exactly. In terms of the materials that are used that contain rare earths. But the mere fact that the U.S. wants to stop the advancement of another country in order for it to try to speed itself up and catch up, I guess that's one reason why the U.S. would do that. Or are we looking at the fact that China has passed the threshold in U.S.'s eyes when it comes to military prowess and strength, when it comes to hot-button issues, for example, Taiwan, which China has not ruled out using military force in terms of reunification? Of course, the U.S. has said we will defend Taiwan at the same time.
Well, I think...
I'm sorry, Peter Koenig. This is for Hazeldine. Sorry. I'll get to you. Hazeldine, go ahead.
Yes, I think it speaks more to the more fundamental level of modernization and development of the productive forces that China has achieved, where now it's the United States which has to catch up with China. But the difference is, of course, that there was a time in which China felt like it had to catch up with the advanced countries and the Western world, and it did so by peaceful economic means, maneuvering its way through the complicated, geopolitical and global political situation. The United States, in its attempt to catch up with China's level of not only technological advancement, but access to raw materials and resources and supply chains, can only do what it knows best and use political military force, rather than find some kind of cunning manner in the same way that China did to maneuver its way into catching up with China. The United States has to, I guess, achieve its economic goals at the barrel of a gun. And what it really speaks to as far as the United States' need to put China down and prevent China's development and growth is, it's part and parcel with the United States' strategy, at least for the past few decades. The U.S. used to be the leader of global economic development, supposedly after the Bretton Woods period. Now the United States only seems like it can maintain its monopolistic position by directly halting and forestalling the development of other countries, whether it's through the IMF and their predatory loans, or through the use of military force to prevent other regional currencies from emerging, as we saw in the Middle East.
Well, Peter Koenig, in order to wrap our heads around what the U.S. wants to do with China, the facts should actually dictate the way we should see things. And that is, when you take a look at the way that China provides the types of goods that it does to countries around the world, it seems like it would just be very close to impossible for it to be taken out. Can't help but reflect on what the EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell actually stated on October 10th, saying that the EU prospered because it got cheap gas from Russia and it was able to get the cheap labor and goods from China, and it was able to prosper. So doesn't the U.S. approach towards China mean that it's going to hit a dead end, and also at what cost, and of course how China is going to react to U.S. aggression?
Well, yes, it's obvious. I mean that China has been for the last how many, 20 years or maybe even more, a growing competition for the U.S. hegemony, and that is of course not acceptable for the U.S. Economy. I mean, the U.S. economy basically right now they can't supply anything that is competitive, not even replacement energy to the European Union after having forced them to cut off the gas stream from Russia. I mean, this is asking the European Union to commit suicide, which they obviously are ready to do. But on the larger scale, it's true. Of course, the U.S. cannot compete with anything that comes from China, and I think this is the long term. This is the threat and the long term fear that the U.S. has, that there will be eventually a unification of Eurasia. And Eurasia includes, I mean, it's the hugest continent of our Mother Earth. That would include about two-thirds of the world population. And China, Russia, India, and Pakistan, and all these countries are going to be part of it. And so if this happens, and I mean, that's a logical step because it's an non-interrupted area that would be economically so strong that there would be no other empire that could survive. And this is, I guess, the long-term threat that the U.S. perceives and wants to abolish, do away with Russia, and then as a next step or simultaneously China. That's where they're encroaching on both of these countries. Sure. So it's very clear, yes, the European Union, of course, itself could be a threat because they have 500 million people, they have a well-running economy. And if all countries, all the 27 countries would put their economic output together, they would have a larger GDP than the one of the U.S. And that's why the European Union was never allowed to become a federation, like a one-country federation like the United States of America.
Sure.
So this is very clearly the reason behind it.
Well, of course, the U.S. is trying everything it can in order to get the European companies onto U.S. soil with the type of energy deals that it's offering, moving towards green energy. But Hazeldine, the South China Sea is another topic that China needs to deal with when it concerns the U.S. because the U.S. is in China's backyard and is trying to maneuver itself and get other countries in that region behind it. Now, the big question is, Xi Jinping obviously realizes that, and conveniently, Xi Jinping is also the leader of the military of China. So conveniently, he can direct that approach, the militaristic approach, if required. Do you think that in his vision after being reelected for the next 5 years, that that's on his agenda and something he's going to act on, given the fact that U.S. will act on its aggression, which all signs are pointing to that?
Yes, I think China, while ramping up its military capabilities, is going to maintain a fundamentally defensive position. I don't think China has any ambitions to tip the scales in any drastic manner itself, though I do think it's preparing for the United States to act rashly whether in the South China Sea or elsewhere. And I think that's really the linchpin of China's overall geopolitical and military strategy here. They're not necessarily looking to start any kind of conflict or fight, but they're definitely preparing and perhaps even expecting the United States to initiate one.
Okay, so when you say that, it's interesting because let's just dial back in time and go back to a month or so ago, where in a span of, I think, a week or 2 weeks, you had all these U.S. officials visiting the island. The most notable one was Nancy Pelosi, which in the beginning there were speculations as to why she would go, because she would be next in line if something were to happen to Joe Biden after the VP, of course. But then we saw all these trips by U.S. officials. That was intense provocation. And we saw with China, how China reacted. And it was a military posturing that China took. So when you say that, that goes against what we just saw happen during that past weeks. So do you still think that that would be the case, the defensive posture? Because that speaks of the old China. Maybe the new China in the next 5 years is not going to be like that.
Well, it should be. Oh, I don't know.
Okay, go ahead. Peter Koenig, to you.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Sorry, Hasseldine. I'll get to you, though. Go ahead, Peter Koenig.
All right. What I think is happening, and I think President Xi was very clear on that, that he says he plans to peacefully integrate Taiwan into the mainland of China, and accent on peacefully. That is a priority because it's an internal affair. However, what he also said, that if there is foreign intervention in this process, then China would use the military. And I think this is very, very clear, and it's also very difficult from the South, from the South China Sea, where the South China Sea is a very largely disputed territory and disputed mostly by the U.S. because they want to encroach on China from all ends. And there it could be very different, that China is putting up military bases on some of the islands which it controls or pretends to control, and there the situation may be different. But I think fundamentally, I agree with my colleague, I don't think they changed their posture of becoming aggressive, but rather defensive, but being better prepared for such a defense than they have been maybe henceforth.
So what is the threshold, though? Tell us, if you can tell us, what line would the U.S. cross when it comes to, let's say, Taiwan, that it would require a reaction from China?
Okay. Well, I think that threshold or red line has been made very clear. If Biden has said they will defend Taiwan at any time, if there's an active intervention in the case of, and I think that has already started, maybe clandestinely, not open to the public, sort of negotiations between Taiwan and mainland China. If there is an active intervention in this process by the U.S. or by anybody, by a proxy from Europe or somewhere else, then I think that would be the red line for China's military to intervene.
I see. So, Hasseldine, the economy obviously is something that China needs to deal with when it comes to not only the world, but also, of course, the U.S. that is trying to put a stick in the wheel, so to speak. Interestingly, when China rolled out the Belt and Road Initiative years and years ago, the U.S. did nothing really, but it came out through the G7 and offered its version of something to, I guess, counter the Belt and Road Initiative. It's called the Partnership for Global Infrastructure Investment. I don't know if you've heard of it, to mobilize $600 billion for middle and low-income countries.
Yes.
Well, it didn't really take off, Hasseldine. It hasn't really gone anywhere, and now we've gone through COVID and now, of course, the Ukraine conflict. Do you think that was a very unsuccessful and big and significant failure on the part of the G7 to stand up to China's Belt and Road Initiative?
Oh, I mean, undoubtedly. You know, the devil is always in the details. I have no doubt that the United States and its so-called allies can commit as much money as they want to kind of try and rival China's Belt and Road Initiative. But what they don't have is the more overreaching strategy, as well as the details about which companies are going to be building this infrastructure, how are they going to do it, where are they going to do it. I don't see that global vision on part of the United States that can rival China's as far as what it expects in terms of increasing global economic interconnectedness, mobilizing using China's most intricate levels of economic planning, state-owned enterprises and infrastructure companies in partnership with other countries and governments. I think what the United States really lacks in that department is a solid level of win-win diplomacy, mutual understanding between partners rather than one domineering empire giving orders and commands to others. And even regardless, China has already, if I recall correctly, committed some $900 billion to the Belt and Road Initiative since it began in around 2013. So even then, if the United States has any intention of trying to rival China's Belt and Road Initiative, it's going to have to deal with two realities. First, it's going to have to dismantle the special relationships China has cultivated with its partners in the Belt and Road Initiative and somehow replace them. And then second, it's going to actually have to catch up in terms of, reaching the level of progress that China has already since 2013. And given the state of economic crisis now plaguing the United States and the internal political crisis within the United States, I just find that highly unrealistic.
Well, the part that I find unrealistic, correct me, Peter Koenig, about this Belt and Road and then the G7 and the U.S. coming up with their own version, is why doesn't the U.S. spend time, because it's infrastructure focused, why doesn't the U.S. spend money on its own infrastructure for the bridges that's falling apart and the schools that are not happening? And, of course, you know where I'm going with that. But I can see that from the little time we have, in less than a minute, China wants the U.S. to be driven out of its backyard. Do you think Xi Jinping is going to be successful in doing that now that he's been elected for the next 5 years? Less than a minute, please.
Yes, okay. Well, I think so, and I don't think necessarily that it will be Xi Jinping who is doing it. I think the U.S. is doing it to themselves. As you mentioned, the lack of reliable infrastructure in the U.S. is a tremendous burden for the public, and eventually they will revolt. They will call on the U.S. to fix their infrastructure themselves. I mean, this is clearly one of the priorities that any decent president would undertake in the U.S. before he goes abroad to try to gather more support from countries that they actually have usurped in the past. And with these 600 billion, these 600 billion would come in the form of IMF and World Bank credits and would usurp further these countries. And they know that.
Okay.
That's why it's not successful.
Thank you. Thank you for that. We're fresh out of time. Peter Koenig, geopolitical analyst and former World Bank economist from Geneva. Hazeldine, thank you, political analyst and host at the Infrared Show from Detroit, Michigan. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Batakhwayi and the team. It's goodbye. Until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. We'll be right back.